This is a Collider.com audio interview.
All these for me? That's weird that you all got me the same thing for my birthday.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear John.
They're your minutes, guys. They're your minutes.
Happy birthday to you.
Thank you. Thank you, one and all.
So everyone that we've spoken with has been talking about how great the script is.
And now it's my turn.
It's a rain.
I mean, even Downey has said he's not tinkering, or maybe not tinkering much. So
yeah, well, no, there's not tinkering, and then there's not tinkering. You'll have to say he had inflection. Everybody's seems to be on board. I'm still working on it. I hope to finish it sometime before the DVD release. But it's been very fluid, but it always is in a movie anyway, and especially a movie where the perspective changes 9 times every scene. I swore I would never make Serenity again, and here I am.
I wanted to ask about that actually, because a lot of writers are kind of like, I mean, it's been comic writers, they're afraid of the Avengers because there are so many characters and group books in general. Bendis, wanted to do group book at one point, and he came back eventually. It was really tough. And was Serenity like the kind of the thing you could do from doing Serenity?
Serenity has been very hard, and I literally said, I'm never doing this again. A bunch of characters who already know each other and established, but have to be introduced to new people and blah, 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 and all that. But I didn't fear it at all. I just regret it very much. It's different. I walked in, I was like, I get why they should be a team. This is exciting. But then you have to explain it to the audience too. Apparently, they matter. So it's Vulcan chess. There's just so many things. Everything, there's a ripple effect on everything you do. But as long as you're respectful of everybody's perspective, everybody has a moment where they shine, or hopefully several. And everybody is speaking from who they are. You're not going to fall too hard.
Is there one sequence? We saw a lot of art before, but is there one kind of sequence that you're really proud of or really excited to work on that you?
I'm not sure there's any one particular sequence that I would say, well, yeah, near that. For me, honestly, that my favorite moments are. The scenes between, where I have two of the characters, where I get to pair up two characters you might not expect to see together and see them go at each other, whether they're getting along or not. There's always friction in that. Now, those scenes, are probably not why everybody might rush to the theater, but they are the most fun when you really get to explore it with the actors and the space. That sort of thing. That's the stuff that I feel the proudest of. I mean, the action is not small. And some of the things, the gags you've come up with are enormous and delightful, and I'm proud of them and excited by them because I like to live in that world too. But when you're in it, when you're in those quieter moments, that's when I'm just in heaven.
Was there a particular scene that you started with? Was there sort of a moment that you said, I have to write this before I write anything else to show that I can do this?
It started out basically with, Kevin and Jeremy and telling me, basically, we know the basic structure of how they come together, what works, what doesn't work, and how we see the climax, which is nice because it gave me a basic skeleton of 3 acts that I knew I had to hang on. And then it was just a question of how do I get there? How do I earn that? What moments would cause these people to be in that situation? I'm very fierce about making sure that everything is motivated, that nothing is, by chance or misunderstanding or coincidence or something that if people are going to fight, if they're going to, face a conflict or an enemy, it has to be internal. It has to be because of something they believe and something they've done, as opposed to just, and now we clock this fight, and now check that box. The whole thing was to avoid that. And I had the luxury of having taken the job and then spending 2 weeks off in Australia with my family, just thinking of moments, just thinking of that moment, that scene, that, oh, this is what this person would say. I wrote more St. Crispin's Day speeches for Cap than you can shake a rattle at, none of which I think are in the film. And, you know, I wrote, you know, monologues for all the characters and long scenes for all the bits of which, you know, wormed their way back in, and many of which fell by the wayside, but all of which informed the characters. I just got to live in that sort of free-floating space for a while. In fact, I lived in the free-floating space for so long that I'm still writing the script, so next time I'll think that one through. But yeah, it all comes from, oh, wouldn't it be beautiful to hear this from Hawkeye or to hear this from the Black Widow.
When we talked to Scarlett and Jeremy before, she said that you had given them a very early draft and then they were able to come back with some notes that they had, and they spoke with you and kind of addressed some things that they had thought after reading an early draft of the script. Can you kind of talk to some of the things that they brought to the table that you thought were important to kind of go back when you were writing your final?
You know, this is such a perfect time to make fun of actors. But the fact is, you know, going into this project knowing that it had been cast largely before I came on board, with the exception of, you know, Jeremy and Mark and some of the supporting roles, you know, I knew that I had a contract with these people to respect what they had already done. And because this is all part of a grander plan, and I did have, for example, those structural elements set, I had this casting set, I knew who these characters were because I'd been reading about them since I was 11. So it was, you know, usually I'd just go and write things and say, why don't you say this? I'll hire you to say this. But in this case, having a dialogue with them was enormously useful because they all had their own backstories or questions about their backstories, and, you know, and I could literally sit them down and say, you know, what are you looking for in this? Because, you know, at the beginning, I'm an open book, so tell me what it is that you don't want to repeat, or you feel like you didn't explore, or, you know, how do you feel? You know, and I would lay out my basic ideas about how I saw their characters. I think my favorite response is, you know, was Sam Jackson's. I was like, you know, is there anything you're particularly looking for? I had told him how I saw Nick Fury, how I saw his role in the movie, anything you're looking for, or anything you particularly want to avoid. He's like, hell no. Thank you for asking. I don't want to run. Don't make me run a lot. And then on set, he pointed to the page. He's like, it says, Fury runs. I know, it just says one time.
What's the most iconic moment for you personally in the Avengers comics, and were you able to incorporate that, or how were you able to incorporate that into the script?
The truly iconic stuff that from the comics isn't really in the film. I mean, you know, it is part of the grand Marvel tradition to steal from all of the comics and all of the eras and Ultimates, and, you know, for me, the Avengers exist mostly in my heart because of the Jim Starlin Avengers annual with Thanos and Warlock, and the Thing 2 and 1 that followed it. That defined why I love the Avengers more than anything. Obviously, that was a long time ago, and Moondragon is not in the film. But it, you know, since then, I think the most important stuff, Civil War, Ultimates, they've amped up the sort of undercurrent of, like, tension between the Avengers, and that makes it really interesting to write. But when it comes to the iconic moments, you sort of have to take all of those things, distill them the same way the costumers do, and everybody, distill them, and then find your own. I mean, ultimately, for me, it's, you know, the most iconic moment in the movie is, you know, assuming they do when they assemble.
I think Bruce Banner and Hulk is the toughest part, because we have seen two other movies, we've seen some two other actors playing him. I mean, you know, Chris and Robert, they've already been playing the characters. We know those characters who are going in there. How have you been working on that, trying to get, having developed your own Bruce Banner with Mark and into the Hulk, you know?
Well, you know, I had a very clear conception of what I wanted Bruce Banner to be, and part of that was Mark Ruffalo. I was like, I want somebody who just opens himself to an audience, who can't help it, who just takes you along everywhere he goes. And the other was Bill Bixby. And that's something that Mark and I both talked about. It's like, I felt that the performances in the other movies were very internal, and the movies themselves led to that because they were all about Bruce Banner was all about Bruce Banner. It was all about, you know, so you have a problem, I need a cure. And, you know, the TV show was about I have a problem and I help other people and I sort of live with that problem. And so that's sort of the way I wanted to approach it, and the way, you know, Mark and I spent a lot of time at the very beginning talking about rage, how it feels, how it manifests, what causes it, what it feels like afterwards, like, you know, the nuts and bolts of just the emotion itself. But in terms of the character, it was very clear that we wanted to just have somebody who had gotten past where he was in those movies, so that when you meet him, he's somebody who's, you know, he's internalized what went on in those movies to the extent that he's someone you like and you're interested in. If you've seen those movies, this would be a natural next step. If you haven't, you'll get the guy. You'll get why he's a good guy.
We saw, we were on the second unit set today, and I'm curious, there's a lot of second unit on this. How involved have you been in storyboarding exactly what they're shooting, or I'm not sure the director's name who's doing second unit.
John Maffey.
How much is he bringing to the table, and how obsessive are you with everything?
I'm pretty obsessive. It's a weird system, because, you know, they had a release date before they had a script. So the moment I came on, I'm like, you know, I think we could open with this great storyboard, Animax, here it is. Or, great! And, which is, you know, necessary when you're moving at this pace, and also can be very frustrating because, you know, you're basically having shots called out by other people, which is not how I usually operate. But when they're good, drink, that'll be fine. I'll take credit for that. And there are a couple of sequences. There's at least one sequence in this where the second unit director gets there before I do, before Seamus, our DP, does, which is, you know, delicate. But everything that they do is very heavily storyboarded, animatic, pre-vised, or, you know, called out. And John is really inventive, really precise, really caring. He and I will spend a lot of time talking about how I'm shooting a scene and what I'm looking for. And so his stuff comes in really, really excitingly and really seamlessly. I've never had a second unit. I shot my own second unit on Serenity. I shot my second unit on Cabin in the Woods. It's new for me to hand that over. But when it's this big, you're going to have to. You're just going to have to. And I have enormous confidence in my crew.
You're shooting with the Aerie Alexa, which Roger Deakins has fallen in love with. Can you talk about why you chose that camera? And why not film?
Because Roger Deakins has fallen... No, it's Roger Deakins. We were going to shoot with the Red, because we were going to shoot in 3D. And everybody said, no, the new rigs are move fast and they're small and it's all going to be great. And I shot the tag for Thor in 3D with that setup. And after we lost 3.5 hours to sort of lens changes and unknowable camera weirdness, we decided to not do that. And I think this was the camera that we always knew we were going to shoot HD. And I have no allegiance to film as film. If the story is in front of me, I'm fine. Seamus had mostly shot film, but he really loved the Alexa. And that was sort of what he wanted to do. And once we were sort of out of the constrictor of 3D for shooting, he said, well, let's go with that. And he loves it, too. He also loves Roger Deakins. So say we all.
Is it true that you pitched in on Captain America, the film, in terms of some of the dialogue? Or
yeah, I did. I did a dialogue polish, which was really, really fun because I got to write 40s dialogue. You know, Cap was a movie that, like, just worked for me. The script was great, the structure, it's gorgeous. You know, they said, we think we can push it in certain places, and I was like, sign me up. What, I have to make the Avengers? That'll be fine, that'll be fine.
How much of that polish, whatever, was you kind of prepping for the Avengers, and specifically the Steve Rogers character? I mean, were you building something in there that was going to lead into this?
I didn't, like, sneak any, you know, particular Avengers Easter eggs in, but I did, you know, I did spend a lot of time with the character, which for me was important because Steve's perspective in this world is very much as anybody's, if not more, the audience's. because he is, you know, he is looking at this world with fresh eyes, and he is not impressed. And you know, his sort of feeling of disconnection, it's something that's going to be laced throughout the film. It's a film about lonely people, because I'm making it. My pony only does one trick. But he is sort of like, he's a classic sort of man out of time, in the very literal sense. And so to have worked on his 40s incarnation even a little bit was, you know, very... It was a nice introduction to this. It kept me grounded in his perspective.
Now, in this movie, you've got all of these characters Marvel needs for future sequels and future franchises. So it's not like you can kill off Iron Man. You know, it's not like you can kill off most of these people.
Awkward moments.
We know you like to kill people off.
So A, we know you like to kill people off for drama in your movies, TV shows, etc. But B, just for sort of stakes on a thing like this, how do you make stakes when the audience knows that the seven main characters aren't going anywhere?
You know, it's a struggle. You know, how do you make stakes when they're all really strong and really tall and handsome? And ultimately, the answer is always that what's at stake has to be more than their lives. It has to be something bigger externally and smaller internally. Like, you know, they have to be going through an internal struggle that matches what they're facing on the outside, so that even if they survive, they may be compromised to a point where, you know, they can't recover. And if you have that, and you really, you know, you really push them towards that, you push them towards something that is, you know, frightening and unlikable, and, you know, a real sort of, you know, a choice that they can't necessarily deal with, then you have some stake. You have emotional stakes that go beyond the hitty and the punchy.
So it's the risk of characters losing themselves more than characters losing their lives.
Yeah.
But there is some loss of life. We saw that scene before that seems to indicate that somebody didn't make it. That seems particularly shaken up.
It's, Tony. It's a sad little film, really.
I was curious, what is the danger? I've got the impression it's a very big movie, like a huge movie, compared to the other. The movie so far. And what's the danger of making a movie so big that the Marvel cannot release another movie because it'll just seem minor? Like, if they do Iron Man 3, it's going to be like, oh, it's not no Avengers because.
Well, that's a good question. The fact is, one of the things that I was very adamant about, and I don't think people were really fighting me on it, but I was, you know, don't have the support systems of all of these movies, because these movies have their own internal workings. They have the supporting characters, they have their own feel. I'm like, first of all, this can't feel like any of those movies. And second of all, you have to take them away from their support systems. First of all, it's a good way to make a team. It's like they all go to camp. And second of all, it's like, you know, they said, do we want to put Jane Foster in the movie? And I'm like, yeah, that'd be great. Then the writer of Thor 2 will come and kill me with a trowel, because, you know, their first meeting happened. I haven't seen you except that one time. There are iconic things going on in their own stories that I'm not going to touch. You know, they have to step out of their worlds into the Avengers world. And hopefully, you know, I mean, yeah, this thing works on a big old scale, but because there's so many of them, you know, everybody gets so much juice and then they have to step aside. The other movies, you know, have a much easier through line. It's never easy, but a simpler through line of that one person's journey, where they really get to explore that person on a level that in this movie I'm just never going to get to.
But this will have to affect those movies, because obviously, like, Jane hasn't seen Thor, but he's here busy fighting whatever he's fighting, and she must be seeing him on TV, like, oh, how can we get him to hide here? You know,
you never call.
Okay. So it's kind of affecting, because you know, things
going on. You can't walk away completely, but I try to do as little collateral damage as possible. As far as I was concerned, the term, I'm in a semi-stable relationship with Pepper or whatever, I was like, that's collateral damage. I mean, are you kidding? What am I supposed to do with that? But in general, you do have to take them to a place they haven't been, and they have to have come back from there in their next movie. But It's a fine line. It's the same thing when you're writing a comic. You know that, excuse me, there's that comic, there's the team they're on, there's the big event they've got. Well, there's all sorts of different masters that you're serving. You know, I guess first do no harm is now the screenwriter's creed. and the second is fuck shit up.
But like with some like Iron Man 2, Favreau's talked about how kind of Marvel came in and wanted him to put certain elements in there for Avengers to set that up. Are there elements that you have or that not have to, but are you planting in Avengers to maybe set something up later on?
Not really. I mean, there's a couple of things that I'm like, this could maybe point to what would happen later, long after I've retired, moved to live in a tree. You know, we're sort of getting here, and you know, I think it can be the death of a movie if you're just smelling franchise.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden you're making Jumper.
Well,
or Aragorn or the Seeker, and you know you really have to. Yeah, I mean you have to just concentrate. This is the culmination of a grand plan that's gone on for years. Beyond that, you know there may be seeds planted, but we don't know what'll grow.
You are a big comic book guy. You're a big comic book fan. You must have a few maybe minor Marvel characters that you're fond of. While you maybe are not planting seeds for sequels, maybe there's a way of putting like little Easter eggs to other characters, like on a street corner or whatever. Are you doing any sort of Easter eggs like that?
Not really. You know, it's so hard for me just to get this job done that I really don't have time to get cute. If they tell me we need, you know, at some point I believe young Stanley Lieber will appear in the film, and that's about as tricksy as I'm getting. There are so many, and it would be so easy, but it's also a way to paint yourself into a corner. If you make reference to somebody, and then suddenly you're like, oh, I want to use that guy, but he knows that guy. Oh Christ, what have I done? You know, I had a cute little Easter egg that's boned a screenplay. Like it's dangerous. They're dangerous waters.
Well, then what about the Stanley cameo? How much fun did you have writing that?
That was fun actually. I mean, I think you're going to see a side of Stanley you haven't seen before. Dark side.
You talk about the other villains in this film. I know we saw them fighting all these creatures on the streets of New York, where you went to in the Marvel Universe and kind of what you were looking for with these.
Well,
other
you know, they handed me Tom Hiddleston, and I didn't really carp after that. Because I had seen, you know, rough cuts of Thor. I had actually seen Tom at the Donmar Warehouse playing Cassio to Chiwetel Ejiofor's Othello a few years ago, and so I knew him from that, and I was, you know, really excited when they said, you know, because Loki was the grand sort of, you know, beginning of the Avengers back in the day, and so to have him, to watch the beautiful performance he gave in Thor, and then to know, like, now I get to take him to, like, some serious-ass evil and build him up was... you know, that was really exciting. We talked about different secondary villains, and I'm not really going to talk about, you know, where we landed on that, but because Loki really is the prime mover, and Tom is primally moving.
Talk about just the, you know, first day of shooting, like the enormity of this hit you, as it hit you and you tried to keep it out of your head, you normally bring this thing people want to see for, you know, 4 years.
Wasn't the first day of shooting. There was a time, there was a moment, a couple weeks after I'd taken the job, where I suddenly went, and my wife just turned to me and said, honey, it's just the next story. I'm like, okay, thanks, good, I'm back. That was it. Because ultimately, it is. You know, the financial burden is not on me. If, you know, as I've said it many times, you know, the first weekend is your job, the second weekend is mine. If the story is compelling, if I got it right, if people want to come back to it, yay. But, you know, I can't really concern myself with the numbers, or I would just go, Benunus, they're large. But it is. It's that scene in Hoosiers where he measures the backboard. It's always just a story. It's like, do you care? If so, we scored. If not, it doesn't matter to me if it succeeds or not. And I found in production, in the first couple of weeks of production, that it was more like making an internet musical than anything I've ever done. Because I was completely at the mercy of everybody's schedules, and, you know, we were constantly having to adjust what we were doing based on what we could get when, and it was very bizarre. It was sort of both ends of the spectrum are exactly the same. There's a ton of circumstance that you have to dance around, and you just adapt.
What are your thoughts
last
on
question, guys.
I want to listen to musical. Because we're talking about other people, about the musical tastes. And, Iron Man was a fabric musical taste. What are your musical tastes for this? And what do you feel? Like, it's going to be like a big bombastic score? Do you feel like you're going to have some metal tunes in it? Or what do you think?
I don't see metal working in this a lot. I mean, there's, unless Tony's playing it, everybody's got their own source. Everybody's got their own vibe. For me, I do think of this as a classical movie. Not bombastic. I don't want to hit people over the head. But I do look to, the John Williams school. Not necessarily the giant march so much as the really soulful, rueful thing that is character specific, is specific to the moment, isn't just a sort of room tone of emotion, but at the same time, because it comes from Cap a little bit. It comes from that sort of that feeling of what we had and what we've lost, and how these people are going to try to regain it.
Can you get Giacchino?
I don't know. Can you? Do you know him? Can you call him?
I think Pixar has a very good relationship.
Excellent.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.